Good morning, everybody. My name's Larry Jacobs. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio, and thanks so much for being with us today. As you know, we are now a part of the American Consortium for Equity in Education, hence all of our podcasts are archived over there, as is our schedule for any given week. Under podcasts, you'll see the icon at ace-ed.org. Again, the American Consortium for Equity in Education, and we invite you to join. Of course, it's free for educators and those interested in education and equity. Again, ace-ed.org. Our magazine is over there, which you will really enjoy. It's called Equity and Access. It is absolutely excellent. We're very proud of it. Okay, please go over, see all the wonderful things we're doing. Enjoy our magazine. Join with us. Don't be shy. It's an industry-supported consortium over at ace-ed.org. All right, and if you want to follow us, you can follow me over at EduTalk Radio on Twitter and Larry Jacobs on LinkedIn and Larry Jacobs or Education Talk Radio on Facebook. And all the other icons are over at ace-ed.org. We're going to talk today about urban education, the effectiveness of virtual learning, particularly for teachers as well as students, and particularly in urban areas. We've got the Newark Trust for Education. All right, is with us today, and with us is their executive director. And Ron, pronounce your last name for me.
Sure, it's Ronald Chalouisan.
Chalouisan, thank you. What is the derivation of that? I had you as Armenian for a little while, as Chalouisan. Yeah,
many people do that. They switch the I, but it's actually my family is from Puerto Rico.
Ah, there you go. Well, thank you, sir. And Ron, it's a pleasure to have you here. Indeed it is, and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And how's life in Newark these days? Any snow on the ground?
No snow on the ground. You know, it's been an interesting 11 months, a lot of things going on, but keeps you on your toes, definitely keeps you on your toes.
It does indeed. And before you became executive director of the Newark Trust for Education, what were you doing? What was your job? Were you in education before that?
Sure. I actually have been in education for 35 years. I was a teacher for many years in New York City, and then I was a principal for a while. And then I developed a charter network for New Visions for charters for New Visions for public schools in New York City.
Good for you. Is that still going on? Is that an ongoing effort?
It is. It's in its, I would say it's probably in its 12th, is it around 12 years now. 2007 was our first set of schools. And so, yeah, around 13 years it's been going on. The schools are doing well. There are 8 schools in that network. Prior to that, as I said, I was in District 2 in the New York City Board of Education for about 25 years.
Wow, pretty cool. Where is District 2? What part of the city?
It's a large swath of the city. It actually runs down the east side across the bottom through both the West Village and the East Village and then up through Hell's Kitchen.
Nice. Wow, that's pretty nice. So what made you take New Jersey Transit over to Newark? You were in New York City for so long, right?
Newark is just an amazing – I feel it's in a really amazing moment in time. I moved over about 4 years ago. I had a really good run in New York. The stars seemed to have aligned and was able to take the kind of the advantages that I was given and turn them into hopefully some advantages for a lot of young kids in New York City. And an opportunity opened up in Newark. I felt like the city – was really moving in a direction that felt very positive. It felt like there was a lot of energy being devoted to education and the young people in the city between the mayor's initiatives and then the move towards local control. When this opportunity opened up, it felt like the right thing to do. And so I moved over and I've been very happy with my move, actually.
Cool. And are you a New York City guy by birth?
I was born in the Bronx, grew up in the Bronx.
There you go.
So I am a Bronx, Northeast Bronx kid. Northeast Bronx
kid. There
you
go. Yeah,
Gun Hill Road area.
Obviously a Yankees fan. I lived in Boston.
You know, absolutely.
I'll let you do the whole podcast even with that blemish on your record. I'll let you do that. Okay, we'll do the whole podcast. Bronx guy, huh? Right. Very good.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, I describe this show, and it's the Newark Trust for Education. We're going to talk about urban education, okay, during this particular time and some of the challenges, et cetera, all right, that you've been seeing. But I actually should ask you, because you didn't actually – I assume that's where your expertise is. Is that the way you want the conversation to go, all about
yeah.
more urban education?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, certainly my experience has been in the urban centers and you know, as I said, much of my time in New York City and now in
yeah.
Newark and a little bit of time in Los Angeles, actually in South Central Los Angeles.
Really?
But,
oh.
yeah, I started my teaching career in a high school out in Los Angeles, Huntington Park High School.
Sure,
and,
Huntington Park.
Kind of
yeah.
learned quite a bit of, it was an amazing entry into the education field, quite honestly. I did learn quite a bit. So, yes, I definitely have had a lot of experience in the urban situation. I just think of education broadly, though, and I think that, you know, when we think about goals and we think about what we want for our young people, I don't see very many differences between, you know, what would probably be considered a more suburban education versus an
mm-hmm.
urban education. I don't see that distinction. For me, the question has always been, how do we ensure that all of our kids are getting the resources necessary to achieve what
mm-hmm.
we know that they can achieve? And so that's been the thrust of my work.
Good for you. And by the way, you just defined equity, which is what by the way, I invite you, please go over to ace-ed.org, ace-ed.org. You'll be interested in what we're doing. Okay.
Absolutely.
That's our American Consortium for Equity in Education. You'll really love our magazine. Okay. Which
Excellent.
Is, we're the only ones focusing on this in all of educational media. All right. We're really pushing for this. So please, I invite you, go over, check it all out, et cetera, et cetera. We'd love to have you join with us, okay, you and your group. All right? So we're talking about equity, okay, and this is the key factor these days. And again, I'm going to say it again, Newark Trust for Education. I assume you deal mostly with Newark. Am I correct? I could go further.
Yes,
but,
most of
yeah.
our work, our direct work is we're part of a number of different kind of networks that help us put the work into the context of both the state and the nation. So,
good man. So, the pandemic hit 10 months ago now. For goodness' God, it's hard to believe 10 months ago now already. Okay,
right.
Talk about what happened when it hit. What you saw as it occurred in terms of equity, if I may. Okay, and how we're moving to get rid of that particular challenge in Newark. That's a good example.
Sure.
Yeah, Brad.
Sure. And so, you know, I think as with every other place, when the pandemic hit, I think it caught everyone, although we kind of knew things were happening, I think it caught everyone a little bit for a loop in
oh, yeah.
understanding the severity and the length of time. So I think a lot of the initial planning, to me, felt very much under the kind of parameters that we would be returning to schools, you know, within a relatively short time, 2 to 4 weeks probably, and that this was a temporary thing that needed to be addressed. And so in Newark, you did see the galvanization of a number of different groups who were working together with both the superintendent of the public, the district public schools, but understanding that in Newark, we have a large population also of students who attend charter schools. A little over 30% of our students attend charter schools. So we have,
mm-hmm.
Are
they public schools? Are those new,
all,
are those
all of the
schools?
All of the charter schools are public schools,
okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And so, right, there are no private charters. They're all public
cool.
charters. And so we really have a consortium of districts in the city of Newark, right, given that the charters are their own districts or networks of districts. And so so we started to look to see, or we saw the galvanization of a number of different groups coming together to think through what needed to happen to make sure that, you know, primarily first and foremost, that all of our kids and families were safe. And then
yeah.
secondly, that they were being able to access education, as with many other places. There was the movement towards remote learning,
mm-hmm.
and immediately, you know, again, I don't think this is surprising to anyone, immediately there was the understanding that families had different levels of access to you know, to the internet, and quite honestly, to the devices within their homes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the initial push could really be described as one in which all of the districts, the charter and the charter districts and the New York Public Schools district, organized around getting devices to young people. That was the thrust of the work, to make sure that every child, every family had a computer available to them, and that they had the internet. Well, actually, in the initial sense, first every child had a computer to them, and then that moved into the understanding that internet access became tremendously important. You know, there was a third element, which quite honestly, I think has not been publicized as much, which is both the training and the technical assistance necessary, right? And that, I think, is a point in retrospect and in thinking about what has been learned, that we should really take a stop in time and think about, as we move into the future, how do we rectify this particular issue so that true equity can be achieved, right? So in the first instance, the level of support for teachers in understanding and using a new medium, or a medium that they might not have used as extensively in the past, is one piece that just, I think, has to be addressed, because we're never, I believe, going to go back to a situation where technology is not a highly central part to the education process.
That's correct. I agree.
Right? It's never going to go back. And so really thinking through what is the systemic approach to supporting our teachers in understanding the medium, much like we have done with helping them really understand the medium of the classroom, right? Our most effective teachers are teachers who understand the resources of a classroom setting, right, which includes the number of kids within that setting. It includes the types of books available, the connectivity available, right, the interactions, all of those things. When you put all of those things together, really the context of the classroom plus the content that's being studied plus the expertise of the teacher creates this amazing learning opportunity within a classroom.
We certainly hope that works together.
Well, yeah, right. And you see it. I mean, we have very many of examples, and we know what that looks like. And there is a lot of support available, you know, both through the district and through unions for teacher professional development, that continues the teacher's professional growth in getting to that place. I think we need to see a similar level of direct intentionality around the use of technology, because a computer is just very different than a classroom, right? What can be done on a computer is very different than what can be done in a classroom.
That's right.
And unless you design for the tool that you're using, there's going to be a miss, right? And I don't think that this is, you know, I don't want this to sound as a fault or blame issue. For me, the notion is, you need to develop the expertise on the tool, and I think it is the system's responsibility, meaning kind of the district infrastructure or the union infrastructure, to provide that kind of support for teachers so that the tools can be best used.
Let me ask this, and I don't know enough about Newark schools in particular. How were the teachers doing with EdTech, or how – I should say it a different way. How was the school district doing with EdTech? I got my air quotes – doing with EdTech prior, to the emergency of the pandemic. In other words, had there been professional development, were there Chromebooks in every classroom? Was there enough connectivity? All that sort of stuff. Where were we before? Because all of a sudden we had no choice. But where were we before? And then where were we at the very beginning? Yeah.
Right. I think that it's a little bit of a more complicated answer, in that it really depended on the kind of grade levels we're talking about and the teachers. Yeah. So there was definitely support for teachers using technology. I would say that in the higher grades, there was a higher proportion of students with technology and with assignments that were based in the use of technology. You know, as you kind of came down the rung of grades, it probably was less and less the use of the technology on a regular basis and the access to the devices. that's kind of a really general statement. And,
yeah, it is. I know.
You know, but kind of generally, that would probably be the way that I would have described it. Certainly with the going to remote, that had to be amped up quite a bit.
Yeah, from 20%
to 100%.
Right. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
A
right.
minor jump. Yeah,
right.
It was a minor jump once it hit.
Right.
And you know what happened? And by the way, Newark was not alone in this. Certainly, we can't just be. We don't want to. We hold responsibility to Newark. It was basically every school district of the country. Not every, but 90% of them. Okay.
Right.
All
well, I had heard at
short.
Some point,
yeah.
right
yeah.
at one point in time. You know, I think that we were hovering. I think on some of the national reports, somewhere between 15% and 20% of families did not have the level of accessibility
right.
necessary. You know, which
is a
call to action really for the
yeah.
nation, right? I think a lot about what happened.
We were called to action long before the pandemic. We just weren't paying attention. And my standing line is we kept kicking the can down the road, and finally we got to the end of the road, and there was a cliff.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. No, absolutely.
I think
you're right.
Yeah,
I think you're right, and I'm not sure if you're aware of there's a Deutsche Bank study that came out probably 4 or 5 weeks ago, maybe a tad bit longer, you know, no longer than 6 weeks ago, I would say, that talks about it's a really amazing study by Deutsche Bank and looks at the digital divide and the impact of the digital divide on minority communities across the nation, and the stunning and scary findings of that study are that in Black and Latino communities, literally because of just access to devices and internet, our students, our families are kind of 10 years behind the skill levels that are true in communities that have access to devices and internet. And when they look out into the future, there is a substantial number, it's a very, very high percentage of Black and Latino youth that they feel that in the 2045 job market, which is really our young people who are in K-1 and 2
yeah.
at this point, right?
We're getting old, Ron. We're getting old.
I know. But
yeah.
oh, I'm way past that. Let me tell you.
Yeah.
But that notion that for those young people, they're going to be locked out of the job market, right? They
yeah.
are absolutely
yeah.
going to be locked out, and that's about having the device. It's about having the right level of internet access, and it's about having the right training, right? These lessons on both use, just practical use, and things like coding. And so when we think about the implications of that, you know, in some ways, the pandemic has shone a bright
yeah.
light on the fact that we have an opportunity here to actually address what could become, and I don't think that this is hyperbole, but I think it has the possibility of becoming kind of our generation's redlining issues. Right. In the past, the redlining
like
issues
yeah.
around.
Yeah.
Right. Right. This
yeah.
notion that we blocked out people
like
from accumulating wealth.
Yep.
Because they couldn't buy homes. Well,
yep.
we're blocking out a whole generation. We have the potential to block out a
blocking
whole generation
access.
Of Black and Latino. Exactly. Which
yeah.
which is
disgusting.
Terrifying. Right. It is really
yeah.
terrifying. It is work that it feels when we talk about a call to action right now. I feel as a city, as a state, as a nation, need to be creating pathways that allow for our communities to have internet access that is affordable and at the right levels. And part of this is, you know, federal regulations which allow for 15 Mbps and 25 Mbps connections, which in reality do not serve the purposes of our communities anymore. If we are not getting access at 200, 250, you know, right now, many of the companies are at 1,000 Mbps, right? That's kind of their stock
mm-hmm.
Piece, but federal government allows for connections to be a 15 and 25, which basically means that in a family of four or five, they can't all get onto the computer at the same time and do video streaming, do conferencing, do downloading. So I just think that this is a real, when we talk about equity and we talk about long-term impact and we talk about the potential for accumulation of wealth and decreasing equity, decreasing inequity over time, to me, this is one of the major, major issues. And, you know, it goes back to, you know, what we were just talking about, which is really what is the support? We talked about the support for teachers, but then there's also what is the support for families and young people in their homes so that they actually have the tools. And at this point, it's not just to access education, right? It's workforce training. It's job privileges. It's health, right? It basically, at this point in time, we are using the computer and access to the internet for socialization, for mental health, for physical health screenings, for job placement, for job access to benefits. Right? Just five key things that if you do not have access, you are cut off from at this point in time. So what are we doing right now to really change that picture?
And after last week, we maybe should cut off the internet 100% after what I saw last week with Congress. I'm joking, of course. Okay. But
no,
we have to.
Yeah.
It's just astounding what's going on out there. You know, you said something when you said Deutsche Bank. I think it's a group called the Center for Digital Equity. Are you familiar with that group at all? Do you know that?
I am not.
I'll introduce you guys sometime today, okay? There's a hidden law somewhere, because you mentioned Deutsche Bank, and then we started talking about digital equity. It's what struck my memory here. There's a hidden law buried in the federal banking laws that banks have to give back to the community X percentage, and I'm kind of generalizing this regulation. Okay, but nobody takes advantage of that, and the Center for Digital Equity has worked extremely hard to get the banks, okay, to understand that the time has come for them to use that money for digital equity, for schools, for education. Okay, I'll set you guys. I'll introduce you later today. They're good folks.
It's
along the same exact lines, and it's a little hidden secret. Okay, that these guys have been working on for quite a while, and I'll introduce you later. You know, I want to ask you something else, and you brought this up as we were planning the show, and this is the key thing. I want to read your whole sentence here, because the first part of your sentence is totally wrong, and then the second part of your sentence is totally right, okay?
Okay.
Part one. So part one of the same sentence. Social-emotional learning is sometimes seen, you wrote, as a neglected area. Well, that's not accurate. Everywhere in the world, they're all concerned about social emotional learning. Then we go to part two, particularly for underprivileged students. And that I probably agree with, okay? Because social emotional learning, SEL, has become a huge thing in districts all across the country. And in fact, as I do these shows with school districts all the time, they always put equity and social emotional learning as their top two priorities these days. Okay, but I don't. And although they all mean it, okay, they don't talk about what they're doing, and I don't get into the urban schools as often, obviously, because there are fewer of them than the bigger schools. I'm curious, as you look at Newark, okay, you wrote that line particularly for underprivileged students. Talk about that. Elaborate on that for a second.
Sure. And I'll start by saying I think it's neglected in areas for the reason I think it's neglected in areas for underprivileged, I don't necessarily like that term, but we'll talk about that differently.
Yeah, well, yeah.
The reason I said that is because I feel many times we conflate the conversation around socio-emotional development with a different conversation, which is about behavior and discipline. And what I mean by that is that the bulk of conversation that, and this is changing, so again, a little bit of generalizations, but many of the conversations that I hear oftentimes in urban districts is our kids You know, we have disciplinary problems. We have all of these issues that are happening within the community. Kids are not focused on education, right? There's all of this. It's a very negative approach to who the young people are. And the thrust of what the trust stands for in the work that we do in Newark has been every single young person is on a growth pattern, right?
Yep.
Every single young person. And we are all learning really how to deal with how we see ourselves, how others see us, how we interact with others, how we interact with individuals, how we interact with communities, how communities interact with us. And that whole thing is socio-emotional development. And so every single child is gaining tools as they go through their home life, through their school life, to help them be members of a community, to be members of society, to interact in a positive way, and to deal with issues that confront them and have different mechanisms to do that. And so when I think about socio-emotional development in schools, I think about what is the overall plan for every young person in that school, for every adult in that school, right? How do the adults in the school think about the young people? What are the positive traits that the young people in that school bring to the table?
Mm-hmm.
And how do you consistently build on those positive traits to broaden the tools they have available to them to cope with, right? Sometimes, as we've been talking about, sometimes systemic issues that are stacked against them. Other times, personal issues. And at this point in time with COVID, we're seeing a tremendous amount of, you know, we think about loss, and sometimes we think about loss equals death, which absolutely is happening for our young people right now, losing family members, losing friends. But it's also about loss of routines. It's also about loss of relationships because of space and distance, right? There's a whole set of losses that our young people are dealing with. So what are the tools that they have to cope with those? And then what are we doing intentionally to help them develop those? What kinds of conversations are we having? And sometimes it's seen as an add-on, right? Oh, we can't do that because we have to teach our young people how to read and do math, which, I have been an educator for 30 somewhat years. There is no one who is more intense about ensuring our kids can read, do math, know history, know science. So, but in that process, there are so many opportunities to really help young people develop these skills that, quite honestly, are skills that last them a lifetime and help them actually grow, develop, and be successful in life. And so that's where I go to the place of I don't want it only to be a conversation about discipline, behavior change, I want it to be a core function of the education system that is about ensuring every single one of our young people have the tools necessary to be successful overall in life.
How's Newark doing on that?
Newark Public Schools has been very, very active in this space. They have been working with, the teachers and the guidance counselors. We've had the opportunity to work with about a quarter of the schools in the district. We look at this kind of in three tiers, with the first tier really being that broad whole school approach. What is the culture and climate of the school building? What does it mean to provide a nurturing, growing kind of culture within a school? And then the second tier being opportunities for different groups of kids who might be dealing with different types or different places in their developmental approach. How might you create these second tier approaches, which means, things like clubs, things like boys groups or girls groups, those types of activities that allow young people to choose forums for them to interact with other young people to develop specific skills. And then thirdly, we definitely do have young people who need additional support. And so how do schools connect with and partner with other organizations within the community that have the expertise to help young people who might need an additional level of support, help them and help their families actually work through those issues. So that's been the approach we've used.
And I hope that's working and working well. We got to go in just a few minutes, but I want to talk about one other thing. And it's interesting you brought this up. You wanted to talk about special needs students and other high need groups. We're talking about Newark in particular here. Okay, and we can extrapolate that out as we go. I wanted you to know something. I'm good friends with a group called CASE, the Council of Administrators of Special Education. It's a big national organization, part of CEC. And I just wanted you to know this. They just told me this last week. They're making a concerted effort, okay, to try to get more people of color to become special education teachers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and they, like they said, like we've all been saying, enough talk. Okay, we want more people of color in education. Period. End of discussion there. But we want people there specifically for special education, which is really a low number right now of people of color in special ed. So it's an interesting little challenge, and it's coming to light more and more. Special needs students in Newark, high needs groups, etc. You say they've been hardest hit this past year. I definitely won't argue with that. What do you see coming in the future for that? Again, let's concentrate on Newark. Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think, and this is a national issue, I think, one of the things that struck me with the opening of schools as far as a public conversation was that that conversation started with and has seemingly continued being all schools need to open for all kids immediately. I think it's the only sector where that has been true, right? Where you think about other sectors, it's been what's the phase-in process? How do we figure out, what can happen and what can't happen? And for me, I feel like this notion of our highest need students should have been the first tier of support. And there should have been a real push for an uninterrupted, continuous.
Are you there?
That didn't happen.
I lost you.
Hello? Hello?
Yes, I lost you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, good. I lost you for just a split second. I thought we had to disconnect it.
No. And so, I felt like there should have been this continuous, uninterrupted line of education. Unfortunately, that did not happen. And, with our students that have IEPs, oftentimes they have multiple services that they need, and which are specialized services. And, not that education and learning is not a specialized service, but more highly specialized support. And so for me, I think as we continue moving forward, I would love to see that particular issue kind of remedied as a first step, right? Ensuring that in these conversations, as we move forward, that special ed students or students with special needs actually get that we prioritize the supports for them as an in-person support. And figure that piece out. I think nationally the statistic is around 14%, 15% of our students are students that have IEPs. So how do we work with that percentage of students immediately to restore the continuous uninterrupted types of learning needs that they have? And then kind of in a longer term, I think, this goes back to even pre-pandemic times. I think that there are questions about the assessment and placement of young people in special needs.
Yes, there are.
Right?
Yes, there are.
And kind
without
of
question.
So really figuring out, what are the screening and assessment tools and strategies that are used? And I think in that context, certainly having many more professionals, and not just teachers of special education, right, but
that's
psychiatrists,
right.
Counselors,
that's right.
Right, who are evaluators, behavioral evaluators, all of these pieces. So that when we look at young people, we're looking at them much more holistically and understanding, what the needs are and not necessarily jumping to a conclusion that a particular young person, because of where he or she comes from or the color of her skin, is a special needs student.
You got that right.
So I think that becomes – I am in a huge, huge, huge belief. I believe very deeply that we do need to recruit and make teaching a viable profession that that is paid at a salary that will allow families to actually meet their economic needs and bring in many more, you know, African-American, Latino teachers. And that's just been, you know, that has been true over the 35 years I've been in education. That I'm not quite sure why it has been so difficult to do that, but it certainly has been. And oftentimes I think it does connect.
And it's interesting because if you look at a lot of the ethnic groups who have come to America over the years, a lot of times that first generation of college students, okay, become teachers. That's kind of a stepping stone of a given generation. Okay, and for some reason, which I haven't figured out yet either, African Americans did not do that. Okay,
well,
and maybe
if you think about though,
it's interesting, and we got to encourage that. I understand it, you know. But go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think we need to be working very diligently to make the educational process a positive educational process for.
Yeah,
Black and Latino students,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. It is hard to understand why. Who the hell wants
right,
to go back to school
right.
and all they did was yell at me all the time?
Right, right.
Yeah.
So if I've never been enough to be a good student, why am I going to go back to teach?
Here.
And that to me is you know, that's a systemic issue around how we, you know, it goes back to this notion of are we seeing the positive traits that young people bring to the table or are we starting off with a negative picture of who's sitting in front of us?
Well, it's unbelievable. Ron, we got to go. This has been really interesting. You're really a terrific guy, so I thank you for being with us here today. Good luck with
everything
you're doing.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you very much.
The
look
pleasure.
Forward to
thank
other conversations.
Thank
Take
you,
care.
And I hope we talk again soon, and you have a good day. And I will send I'll figure out that Center for Digital Equity and get back to you today. Okay?
That sounds great. Thank you very much.
I will.
Take
I promise.
Care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Ron is the executive director of the Newark Trust for Education. Just Google it. Okay, it's cool. They have a nice website. And it's at Newark Trust if you want to follow them on Twitter. But all you heard is pretty good guy. So Ron's executive director. We're going to archive over at ace-ed.org, our American Consortium for Equity in Education. All of our Twitter and stuff is all over there. You can see the icons. My name is Larry Jacobs. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio. Thanks so much for listening.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.